So with the three methods for refueling the aircraft available, the normal procedure was to land the aircraft, to wash it down with the fresh water, refuel, change the crew if necessary, and then launch the aircraft again. How much time was saved, if you can remember, doing the hot refueling where the aircraft doesn't even touch on the flight deck, as opposed to landing on the flight deck, having it secured in the bear trap, then carrying out the wash down and the refueling, and then launching the aircraft again?
I think the turnaround time was a couple of hours, but I'm only guessing now. This is a long time that I was not really paying attention to that part of it.
Right.
But I reckon it took about a couple of hours to completely resurface the aircraft and prepare for launching again.
All right.
If she was already airborne, it's just how long did it take to pump the fuel in?
And then
she'd keep going.
And you have a recollection of that being about half an hour.
Well, the trial was half an hour. Now, how much fuel she took in, I don't know at that time.
Right.
It may have taken a little longer, but I don't think it would have been anywhere close to the time it would take to shut down and then start up again.
Right. And we can assume that that those times were improved upon because this was just trials, and
yeah,
they weren't
all trials. This was to set up and work out the routines to use. You know, does it work now? What routine do we use to make it as efficient as possible?
Right.
Once you get that down, of course, the speed at which you carry out a routine increases with the just frequent drills.
Now, when we go back and talk about the three-man crews for fire duties and figuring out the right numbers and the positions and all those sorts of things and undergoing their training, was there a great deal of cooperation and exchange of ideas between yourself and the pilots and the detachment that would have been embarked in VX-10 to work these sorts of things out?
The detachment commander from VX-10. And I had quite a few discussions about how we wanted things to be.
So the cooperation and exchange of ideas was between yourself and the CEO of VX-10?
Well, it was detachment commander, because this was his project. He was the project officer.
All right. And who would have that been?
It was Zbytniew.
Zbytniew.
Yeah.
All right. Now, and reports would have been written, I assume, following these discussions?
Yeah.
And were they joint reports that would have been
submitted? No, it was his trial, and he talked to me, he talked with our captain. The three of us would be involved in the discussion, our engineer, VX-10's engineer.
Right.
We'd all get involved in this, and then, as far as I know, Zbytniew wrote all the reports.
Would the LSO have been involved in those sorts of conversations as it relates to
some of them, yeah.
To the fire crew, for example?
Not really, no. Fred was not involved with the fire thing. It was mostly the detachment commander, myself, and how we'd lay the set the fire crews out. It was his and my discussions where we got the second ladder. Originally, the ladder went down the center of the after end of the flight deck to the quarterdeck, and
right.
We had it moved over to one side and a second ladder put in. And that was as a result of our joint discussions.
And I assume that would have been to increase the time or decrease the time that it took the fire crews to get up to the flight deck to start hosing down the aircraft?
Decrease them, and also to allow them to come in from two different angles.
All right.
From each corner of the flight deck.
All right, okay. Now, trials or exercises would have been conducted on this sort of thing all the time. In order to decrease the time that it was taking the men to actually get to their stations, I assume, too, to drop everything, what they were doing at the time, and to be all suited up in their protective gear, standing ready at the hoses. Would that be accurate?
Part of the drill was to make sure that they were ready to go as soon as, in the least possible times.
Right, okay.
So they'd lay their clothing out, their protective clothing out, in such a way that they knew which hook theirs was hanging on and how to jump into it.
So as the XO overseeing all of these things. You were quite happy with how the drills and the exercises and trials were proceeding?
Mm-hmm.
All right. What about the divers themselves? Was that a requirement that VX-10 placed aboard the ship?
Well, the ships were supposed to have the rescue divers, the shallow water divers, and that was so that was part of the having somebody available for VX-10. And now whether VX-10 wanted us to have them or it was just normal to have them, and we decided that they should be dressed we did. Yeah.
So that would have been a total of four men then, two watches that had their tickets to carry out the diving operations?
I think the minimum you were supposed to have anyhow was five.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that was always a nagging feeling in the ship because we had a diving officer and four men, and that's all we had. And every time we sent people off to get qualified, they either got posted, or they came back in time when somebody else got posted away, or we got they failed to qualify for the course. I took the course myself, and got an infection in my ear and had to withdraw from it.
Right.
So I never qualified.
So you maintain that same level of personnel.
But we tried, and it was always a worry to make sure that we had enough divers on board.
I assume that would have been a really difficult operation to attempt to extract aircrew from a Sea King that had ditched in the ocean, would it not?
Well, Sea King will stay afloat for a short space of time.
Depending upon conditions?
Yeah.
All right.
Although they had what appeared to be floats where the wheel wells were, she wouldn't stay afloat vertically. She'd want to flop over.
Right. Top heavy, the wind would just take her over.
She'd tend to kick over. But they apparently there was enough air could be trapped in the various compartments to keep it afloat for a time.
Right. Would the diver actually enter into the aircraft in order to
never
extract?
Gave it any thought. Get those guys out, and that's how you got them out,
right,
and dragged them back to the ship. It was entirely up to the diver and his enthusiasm. The fire crews, when they practiced on the dummy burning aircraft,
mm-hmm,
out at the Sandwich Battery, where the school was, they did not enter the bird at a rescue. That was up to the two qualified rescue specialists from the air detachment.
All right.
And they were the people. Forgotten what they were trained firefighters, but they wore the silver suits, and
mm-hmm,
they in fact were supposedly able to walk right through a burning pool of aviation fuel.
Right.
I never saw anybody do it, but mm-hmm, they told me they could.
would the divers have practiced on a mock-up for extraction of air crew?
I don't know. No, I don't think so.
All right.
They might have been introduced to the type of thing, but their main thing was you've got tanks on, you're qualified to 36 feet,
mm-hmm,
don't go any deeper.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're going to pull somebody out of a sinking aircraft, make sure you leave the aircraft before it gets below 36 feet on its way down.
Right. Last place you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while you are working through these sorts of issues, determining numbers and setting up the watches and that sort of thing, is VX-10 also working through similar sorts of problems, determining the size of what the air detachment is supposed to be for?
Yeah, they were concerned not only because of the limited accommodation in the ship, the composition of the detachment. They thought they had a pretty good idea, but they did make a few changes, I gather, from how many aviation electronics people they should have,
mm-hmm,
versus aviation engine people they had.
Right.
We did an engine change in the hangar with them while they were working on it. Actually had a preserved engine on board,
mm-hmm,
a spare engine, and they took out one engine and stripped down de-preserved the engine in the package and hoisted it up in the hangar and put it in and connected it all up, working on the time it took them while the ship was underway, and could they run up the tests without running into any problems, and how many actual physical bodies they needed in whatever skills. So the composition of the detachment, I think the size of it was pretty well constrained upon us, but
all right,
they were working on the composition.
That strikes me as being a very difficult task to carry out in such close quarters. There's not much room in the hangar.
Well, the hangar is as wide as the
flight deck, I assume.
You know, the two wheel wells,
mm-hmm.
And you could walk around the aircraft. And there we, in this on the mezzanine deck, where we had quite a bit of stuff stored, there were platforms that would come out, so you could step out.
Oh, I see. All right.
We had hinged.
Was there much clearance between the top of the rotor head and the hangar?
No, not a lot.
Enough
to lift the rotor head off, though.
All right.
You could have taken the rotor head off in the...
So was there a small hoist or small crane at the top of the hangar?
Yeah.
All right. What was the normal size for the air detachment then? I seem to remember reading figures of anywhere from 11 to 13. Would that be...
13 rings a bell.
All right.
And but I can't remember what trades they were.
Okay.
Or who they were. Nearly all skilled tradesmen, but there were some Killicks and able seamen amongst them. The two aircraft handlers, the crash rescue people, were of course leading hands.
Right.
One of the engine mechanics was a leading hand, and the other one I think was a chief, you know, sort of acted as mate for him.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember the exact composition of it.
Right.
Because one of the things I said we decided on when we very first was they would not have a special mess.
Mm-hmm.
They would mess in mainly so that everybody would realize they're on a team.
Right.
You know.
And how did that work?
That worked fine. I didn't want anybody saying, well, there's special places for special men and special routines and all that. And I didn't like that idea. Although they sort of tended to end up in one corner of a mess deck.
Mm-hmm.
Those that were there just sort of drifted together. But mostly they worked well. They, you know, they had their chums. They had their time. When their times were off, they were off. And so they tended to go ashore with people they knew.
Right.
But they did live with amongst their the whole ship's company, and that worked well.
Great. Now, what was the ship's company size aboard the Annapolis?
200. Yeah, we had 265, and her number was 265.
Boy.
I'll go and get the coffee.
All right.
You want to put that on?
So following the local trials that were carried out either in Halifax Harbor or just off of Halifax, where did Annapolis proceed for the heavy weather trials?
We crossed the Atlantic and worked with the NATO squadron, and whenever there was any sort of a sea or swell, well, we'd do a launch. So the heavy weather trials really got going on when there was heavy weather, and that seemed to work okay. We got the data we wanted, and I was interested in the launching, because of course the center of support of the aircraft goes from the bottom of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The center of gravity doesn't change, but it goes from the bottom to the rotor head, from the wheels to the rotor head.
Right.
So you end up with a very unstable aircraft for an instant as it's being transferred. And if the ship was rolling,
mm-hmm.
you could cause a problem, because you know, instantaneously the aircraft's going to fall over on its side because it's very unstable. So it was the timing of the launch and releasing from the bear trap had to be very closely watched, and that's where the LSO and the pilot were in direct contact, and they were watching the ship as it moved.
Now, from what I understand, all LSOs were qualified helicopter pilot.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So during the actual takeoff of the aircraft from the flight deck and the bear trap, the LSO was the person that was responsible for waiting for the lull between the waves in order to launch or recover the aircraft?
Yeah.
That's accurate? All right. What sort of sea states did you encounter during the heavy weather trials? Do you have any recollection of that?
I don't think we got over much over Sea State 6 at the very most.
All right. So what sort of role would you be encountering for recovery of the aircraft during that sort of sea state?
Well, Annapolis, with her fin stabilizers operating, roll was probably not much more than 15 degrees either side of vertical. What did happen was the vertical displacement of the flight deck, because it didn't matter so much the ship rolling. Mm-hmm. was if it fell into a trough just as the plane was going to come land,
right,
the plane would have a lot further to drop. And again, if it was suddenly on a rise, as it rose on a swell and the aircraft was coming down, it would make a much heavier landing than it planned.
Right.
So the LSO had to judge his tension on his haul down wire very carefully and watch it very carefully as he brought the aircraft down.
But the LSO would be looking aft and mm-hmm. looking at the flight deck and the approach of the aircraft coming in over the flight deck. So how aware could he be of the next swell coming, seeing he's looking in the wrong direction? So what sort of communication would there be between the bridge and the LSO, for example?
No, nothing direct in that respect. Of course, if we saw him out in the sea, we'd soon let him know. But he could watch the horizon aft and could see what the ship was doing.
All right.
And for the most part, sea swells and heavy waves are fairly regular.
Mm-hmm.
You do have your giant rogues and all the rest of it, but for the most part, they're fairly regular.
Right.
So as the ship starts moving up, you knew that the period of roll or the period of pitch or the rise and on the crest and falling off into a trough would be 15, 20 seconds between peaks, and you could soon time it.
All right. Now, there's a number of things to be aware of during the landing operation. Pitch is one, and yaw is another, and roll is another. What combination or sort of single variable is the most important in terms of the landing operation with the aircraft? What presents the most danger?
Because not being a pilot, I really couldn't say which he'd be more concerned about. But my thoughts were that it was the physical displacement of the ship, vertical displacement, that would cause the most concern to the people in the aircraft and on the flight deck.
Right.
Rather than the yaw, because the helicopter is very maneuverable,
mm-hmm.
and it could yaw back and forth with the ship. And I've watched them hover over the flight deck, and we've been in some fairly wild seas, and yet he was having no problem staying where he wanted to be.
Right, okay. Were the stabilized fins only used during takeoff and landing operations?
Only if they were needed, yeah.
All right.
If there was any sort of weather. The hydraulic pumps that operated them were very noisy, and one was under the sick bay, and the other one was under some decks, but under a mess deck in the wardroom.
Right.
And they would cause a lot of disturbance if they were run for any length of time.
So,
and
ships
you couldn't carry on a conversation.
Oh, really? If they were that loud?
Yeah.
So, wherever possible or whenever possible, if you could get away without using them.
If we didn't need them, we didn't use them.
All right.
And of course, they used a lot of power too, because they were physically bending the ship back the direction it didn't want to go.
Right.
And that's fuel.
Just if we could go back, I've just thought of another question. One of the problems during the early trials aboard Buckingham, the Prestonian class frigate, and HMCS Ottawa, was the lack of fresh water for washing down the aircraft, and having enough fresh water for the ship's company for drinking purposes and showering and that sort of thing. Was that a problem even during the Annapolis trials, or was there more than an adequate supply?
No, we had built into us additional distilling capacity. Remember, we were still using the steam distillers.
Right.
So we had a bit more capacity there, and we also had an additional freshwater tank built
solely devoted for washing down the aircraft.
So we had additional water. And watching the washdown, they had a spraying system for washing, which was very, very economical in the amount of water it used, even for washing out the air intakes. That was one of the biggest problems, corrosion on the turbine blades.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to put water into the air intake for the engines.
Right.
While they were turning around slowly, just to rinse them all off. And they used, maybe 2 or 3 gallons of water, and that was it for that. So they had a very, very efficient way of using it.
Oh, I see. All right.
Mind you, the stuff that came out was pretty salty.
I can imagine. What were your impressions of the seakeeping characteristics of Annapolis? You've got the large superstructure of the hangar now, which would catch a lot of wind. What were your impressions?
As a seaboat, she was excellent. Trying to bring her alongside in a crosswind
mm-hmm.
in Halifax Harbor was tricky. Bob Pierce was a very excellent ship handler, and Dan Mingy was not particularly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So Dan caused a few creases in the ship's hull because the wind caught him at the wrong time, and he didn't anticipate it as quickly as Bob Pierce could.
Right.
And that's not saying Dan Mingy wasn't a good officer. It's that some people have this knack of feeling a ship. I've got it to a certain extent.
Right.
Probably not as good as Bob Pierce did, but Bob could feel a ship and instinctively do the right thing with the rudder or the engine movements
mm-hmm.
To counteract it before most people would even notice it was happening.
That could be very, very important.
Yeah. And Dan Mingy would study a situation, and then if it didn't go quite that way,
mm-hmm.
well, he'd have to restudy it, and this, he'd lose several seconds while he reassessing the situation.
So coming alongside the jetty was more problematic than as it relates to wind than being out in the open ocean dealing with landing operations.
The whole hull design, even with the superstructure, but the hull design was really an efficient hull, and they made them very good seaboats.
If you remember, because there doesn't seem to be too much paperwork on this, up to what degree of roll could you attempt to recover the aircraft? You said that you had encountered roll of about 15 degrees during the heavy weather trials. Could you recover in a higher degree of roll?
We think so. I can't remember anything being higher than that, but I think that was about... 15 seems pretty tremendous if you're standing on a deck and the ship's heeled over that far.
I'm sure.
And if it comes back and heels over...
The other way.
The other way, you think you've rolled a lot.
Now, this was all encountered when you were attached to the NATO squadron for the heavy weather trials?
Most of the heavy weather trials were with the NATO squadron.
What was the impression of the NATO countries with the VX-10 trials and the capability that the RCN was now or soon to acquire, embarking heavy helicopters aboard small warships?
The professional seamen thought it was just great. This was really something.
Mm-hmm.
To have an aircraft with that capability, because the Sea King, of course, could carry four homing torpedoes, plus stay airborne for 2 hours, and had the dipping sonar. So she was an attack unit all on her own.
Right.
And extended the range of the ship tremendously. The nearest thing the British had was in a much bigger vessel, in a much less capable helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, and the Americans just had their lamps, which was basically a weapons delivery system if you didn't have to go too far because there was precious little fuel on board.
And if I understand correctly, the the lamps were all directed by the ship itself, yeah. and their hull-mounted sonar, too, I
yeah.
think. Is
yeah, that, all it was carrying a weapon out to wherever it was supposed to go, and that was about it.
And they had a lot of problems with that particular yeah. program, if I remember correctly.
So the professional seamen thought we'd hit on the right combination, and we did quite a few demonstrations while we were with the NATO squadron as we visited the various countries, showing our great idea of the haul down and the bear trap.
Mm-hmm.
And the traveling, of course, bear trap, once it caught the aircraft, would move it back and forth on the...
Traverse it in and out of the hangar.
In and out of the hangar, which meant you didn't need a big flight deck crew to move the aircraft around.
Right.
So that was considered a plus as well. So they were... But what the politicians at the other end thought, I don't know. I did... this is an aside, but I was loaned to Industry, Trade, and Commerce to try and sell some other equipment to Europe.
Right.
And the general attitude is, you've got a splendid idea there, fellas, but it's too rich for our blood.
Oh, really?
So I think this is probably that the what they were looking at in terms of the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
You've got an awful big helicopter, and it costs a lot, and you've got a very sophisticated system to haul it down, and it costs a lot, and we can't afford it.
That's somewhat ironic, because we couldn't really carry on with the fixed-wing carrier aviation because of the great costs involved, and this is partly, or one reason, why we got into this game, because it was so much cheaper than operating the carriers.
I'm thinking of the Germans and the Danes and the Norwegians.
Mm-hmm.
Who have navies that are comparable to ours, and the Dutch as well. And the Dutch produce very sophisticated vessels, but they just found our... and the Dutch were running an aircraft carrier at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether they thought maybe that the British system was probably simpler
right.
than ours. And, of course, the Americans waited until the patent ran out, and then they've got the hull-down system in their ships now.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any recollection of what the U.S. Coast Guard thought of the bear trap and haul down system? I know that they had attended a couple of demonstrations, one at least during the Assiniboine trials, but I'm just wondering if they sort of...
They were very impressed at the working level.
All right.
They thought it was a great thing. But at the political level, when you're talking about spending taxpayers' money, you have to remember what you're going to spend it on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always an industrial spin-off. We're not the only country that talks about it.
What about for the night weather trials? Was that something that was carried out following the attachment to the NATO squadron?
I can't remember exactly when we were involved in that, as far as chronologically, but it was later on, because getting the artificial horizon fitted, we had really a lash-up to start with. Sort of made in somebody's aircraft back, some workshop in the back of some aircraft hangar and over at Shearwater, I think.
Right.
Came back, tried it, went away, and at one stage it was a piece of 2x2 wood,
mm-hmm.
With the light band on it as the stabilized light, and then eventually we got more and more sophisticated. And when I went back to visit Annapolis, about a year after I had left her, I was at a conference in Halifax, and the ship was in, so I went down to see a couple of old chums who were still on board, and I noticed that there was quite a sophisticated looking artificial horizon by then compared to what we played with to start with.
Now, you had said earlier on the tape that that the hot refueling while the aircraft was borne and hovering just off the flight deck made you feel somewhat uncomfortable or a little bit nervous. What was your reaction to night trials and night operations?
That didn't bother me, because they seemed to come in, well, it came in from astern anyhow, yeah, slightly off the stern. We towed a marker, you did some cloudy weather, you know, poor visibility trials as mm-hmm. well, and we towed a fog marker astern and homed him in on that. Then he'd come up following the fog buoys being towed astern of the ship, and they could see the splash, and then that would
get them onto the wake, and they'd come up the wake.
Oh, I see.
And some of the night trials they did in thick weather, mm-hmm. or in the tropics, where we got lots of phosphorescence, so he came up the up the wake. But no, I wasn't concerned about that, because he came in until he could see the flight deck lighting,
mm-hmm.
and then he was on and settled down and down. So I had no fear of him overflying the flight deck and running in, flying into the hangar.
All right. We'll just stop the tape here and pop in another one.